Chapter 5. Why do we do what we do? Motivation and emotion. Feelings do not just give color to our experience or provide the emotional weather through which we travel. They serve a purpose. They provide an impetus to action, and we often explain our actions in terms of those things that we felt at the time. I thumped the table because I was angry, avoided speaking because I felt nervous, or found myself a drink because I felt thirsty. Motivations, hunger, thirst, sex, determine the goals towards which I strive, and emotions, happiness, frustration, despair, reflect the feelings I experience along the way. However, the two are often grouped together in psychology textbooks, and when not explained, the juxtaposition can be mystifying. What have anger and thirst got in common, other than that you can feel them? The main reason for treating them together is that they galvanize us into action. We talk about them as if they were forces within us, pushing us this way and that, forces that are felt in the body, which keep changing, and which may not always be understandable or logical. But they are not independent of other psychological factors. They both influence, and are influenced by, the processes described so far: perception, attention, learning, memory, thinking, reasoning, and communicating. And one of the problems for psychologists is to work out how these processes interact with feelings to explain why we do what we do. Emotions organize our activities. They tell us what we want: to do well at work, a good meal, time out from all the hassle, and also what we do not want: another argument or increase in taxes. They bring with them a tendency to act in a particular way. Emotions can function as motives. A distressed or frightened child will seek comfort and security, or cry out for help. And, mostly, people seek to be close to those that they love. So logic is not enough. Imagine trying to decide what job to do, who to trust, or even marry in the absence of feelings. All of the sophisticated mental equipment inside the human head has evolved so that when it functions well, it helps us to get what we want and to avoid what we do not want. Motivations and emotions are the mobilizers of the otherwise purely mental machine, the fuel in the tank, and the way we behave, whether taking action or deciding not to do so, depends on the way in which feelings interact with the rest of the equipment. Motivation, the pushes and prods. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, motivation is the conscious or unconscious stimulus for action towards a desired goal provided by psychological or social factors, that which gives purpose or direction to behavior. Or, in psychological terms, as George Miller said, all those pushes and prods, biological, social, and psychological, that defeat our laziness and move us, either eagerly or reluctantly, to action. The motives behind our actions are guided by several forces. Hunger is a biological motive, acceptance a social one, and curiosity a psychological one. So motivation is complex. Hunger, for example, is determined by external as well as internal factors, by the smell of newly cooked bread, as well as by the emptiness of the stomach. If I am hungry, I look for food, and the hungrier I am, the harder I look, and the longer I look for. Hunger determines the direction, intensity, and persistence of my behavior, but it does not determine all aspects of my eating behavior. I may also look for something to eat when I have an ache in my heart and not in my stomach, or just because that is my habit on entering the house. Psychologists have categorized motives in illuminating ways. primary motives help us to satisfy basic needs, such as those for food, drink, warmth, and shelter. These needs have to be satisfied to ensure survival, and they do not respond readily to attempts to control them voluntarily, one reason why it is so hard to diet. Some of them are cyclical, for example, eating and sleeping, and the force with which they are felt increases and decreases in a more or less regular way. However, even these cyclical patterns are products of complex interactions. People who eat at regular times feel hungry if they miss a meal, whereas those who nibble all the time or eat at irregular times notice hunger pangs less. Secondary motives, such as friendship or freedom, or honor, power, wealth, fame, and the love of women, according to Freud, are acquired or learned, and the needs they satisfy may or may not be indirectly related to primary motives. Earning money enables me to satisfy a primary need for food and drink, but doing something creative, like writing a story, appears not to be related to a primary need. Some secondary motives are easily recognized: the need for friendship or for independence, or being nice to someone out of guilt. Others may be outside conscious awareness, such as those things that I do to enhance or protect my self-esteem, or may be used as rationalizations for behavior, avoiding conflict so as to keep others happy. In 1954, Maslow constructed a hierarchy ranging from lower-level needs, satisfying which reduces deficiencies in physiological systems, needs for food and water, to higher-level personal or abstract needs. His hierarchy of needs read as follows from lower to higher: survival, safety, love and belonging, self-esteem, cognitive activity, aesthetic experience, and self-actualization and personal growth. Maslow believed that higher-level needs will only emerge when lower-level needs are satisfied. The value of this theory has mainly been in the impetus it provided to the development of humanistic types of therapy. Many people in modern societies feel unhappy despite having their basic physiological needs met, which suggests that personal growth and the need to fulfill one's potential are important motivating forces, and more significant and profound motivators in humanistic terms than lower-level physiological forces. Man cannot live by bread alone. However, the theory has little empirical support, and self-actualization, which has no clear definition, may in practice depend upon external factors such as educational, cultural, and economic opportunities, at least as much as it depends upon motivation. There is, as yet, no adequate theory of motivation that accounts for all that is now known about lower-level motives, such as physiological needs, and about higher-level needs in which cognitive factors are important, such as the desire to be liked and accepted. However, it is clear, when it comes to understanding why we do what we do, that we need to encompass both types of need. Two contrasting theories illustrate the ways in which psychologists have thought about motivation: homeostatic drive theory and goal theory. The basic idea in homeostatic drive theory is that it is important to maintain a reasonably constant internal environment. Any move away from this, or imbalance, prompts action to restore the balanced state. The action is driven by the sense of imbalance and continues until the balance is restored. The physiological effects of hunger send us to the kitchen, and eating what we find there reduces the disequilibrium or discomfort caused by the hunger. drive reduction theory incorporated ideas about reinforcement into this basic homeostatic theory, suggesting that behaviors that successfully reduce a drive, like eating a chocolate when you are hungry, will be experienced as pleasurable and thus be reinforced. The motivation to continue the behavior decreases as the drive is satisfied. We should, therefore, slow down or stop eating when no longer hungry. What we actually do will depend on a combination of motivation, the hunger drive, or perhaps just the need for pleasure, and learning about chocolates, where to find them, and how many of them one can eat before feeling sick. The theory explains some aspects of complex behavioral patterns, refusing to eat so as to get attention, quite well. Satisfying the need for attention may help to reestablish a normal pattern of eating. However, the notion of drives does not apply to other aspects of behavior, such as tasting a new Mexican salsa or eating the parsnips so as not to cause offense. Social, cognitive, and aesthetic factors motivate much of our behavior, and these cannot be explained by drive reduction theory without postulating a drive to match every contingency, a drive to listen to Schubert and another for listening to Miles Davis, or walking along the top of the hill. In contrast, goal theory attempts to explain why we do what we do in terms of cognitive factors, suggesting that the key to someone's motivation is what they are consciously trying to do, their goal. This theory suggests that people will work harder and use more resources when the goal is harder to achieve, and the harder the goal, the higher the level of performance. An experiment testing this theory in the workplace was conducted in 1975 with the hypothesis that people given the hardest goal should perform best. The method used, three sets of workers were given the task of cutting and transporting wood, working in small groups. The do-your-best groups were given no goal. The assigned groups were given a pre-assigned hard goal, and participative groups were required to set their own specific hard goal. The results? The do-your-best group transported 46 cubic feet of wood an hour, compared with 53 cubic feet for the assigned group and 56 cubic feet for the participative group. Goal setting has been shown to improve performance in 90% of the relevant studies, and it is especially likely to do so under the following conditions. People accept the goals set, they are informed about their progress, rewarded for achieving goals, have the ability to reach them, and are appropriately supported and encouraged by those in charge. These findings have been usefully applied in work settings, although we still need to know why some workers set higher goals than others, and how the motivating forces mobilized by setting one goal interact with others, physiological or social, and so on. Different motives, therefore, interact differently with physiological, cognitive, and behavioral systems, so that homeostatic drives play a central part in determining primary motives, and cognitive factors such as goals are more influential in determining secondary motives. For many of the things that we do, a complex set of motives is involved. Research findings in this field have many practical applications, for example, in helping us to motivate people to learn and to work, and helping us to understand and combat difficulties in motivational systems, such as those that result in obesity and the difficulties of dieting. Emotion. It has been very difficult for psychologists to provide an adequate definition of emotion, partly because measures of its components do not consistently correlate with each other. The five components psychologists distinguish are physiological, heart rate and blood pressure changes, expressive, smiling, frowning, slumping in a chair, behavioral, making a fist, running away, cognitive, perceiving a threat, danger, loss, or pleasure, and experiential, the complex of feelings experienced. I can smile when I am sad and feel fearful without my heart rate changing. And this lack of correlation means that emotion cannot be properly studied and understood by measuring any one of its components. Are there primary emotions in the same way that there are primary colors? The issue is unsettled, despite much cross-cultural and cross-species research initiated by Charles Darwin. The facial expression of some emotions, for example, fear, anger, sadness, surprise, disgust, and happiness, are sufficiently similar to be recognizable in people from different ethnic groups and also in many animals. However, possibly because of the lack of concordance between the five components of emotion, a much greater variety of emotions can be identified at the experiential than at the physiological or expressive levels. And, of course, there are as many types of smile and frown as there are people to express them and situations to provoke them. Complex emotions like guilt and shame, which are strongly determined by cognitive factors such as what we think about ourselves, what we think others think, and internalized social rules, do not, so far as we yet know, differ physiologically and are easy to confuse if one relies solely on observable expressions. Most of the time we experience mixtures of emotions or shades of feelings as various as the colors we perceive, rather than pure states. Although there are common aspects of these feelings, so that you and I can both feel sad, recognize it in each other, and know what we mean when we talk about it, my experience of sadness will differ from yours. The meaning that it has for me, and the way in which I am able to express it, is determined by the way in which it fits into my world right now, by my past experience, memories, thoughts, reactions, and the ways in which others have previously reacted to my feelings of sadness. If they have told me to go away and stop bothering them, I may hide it or find it hard to talk about. The point is that both the experience and the expression of emotions are products of complex processes, which psychologists are only now beginning to understand. Different emotions appear to be governed by different parts of the brain. Anger and sadness predominantly involve the right hemisphere, while emotions such as happiness mostly involve the left hemisphere. Even week-old babies respond to different emotions differently in their two frontal lobes, a part of the brain that is known to have special significance for emotion. This could be because the two hemispheres are also differently specialized for the control of muscles, with the right hemisphere having better control over the large muscles involved in fight or flight. Whether this specialization confers other advantages is not known, but there is evidence that the part of the brain called the limbic system functions as an emotional center, and that layers of convoluted gray matter, or the cortex and neocortex, developed later in evolutionary terms, thereby adding the ability to think about feelings, amongst other things. Information travels speedily and directly into and out of the limbic system, only reaching centers of cognition later, thus making us susceptible to emotional hijacking. The burst of anger or paroxysm of fear that overtake us despite our having decided to remain calm and in control of our sensibilities. In extreme fear, We may react primitively by jumping out of the way of the juggernaut, thus saving our lives, or more thoughtfully by calling appropriate emergency services. A primitive reaction to hunger might involve eating all the chocolates available, like a bear that gorges on autumn fruit before the winter cold starts. And a more reasoned one involves holding back or not giving in. So, strategic behaviors are needed to combat the pressure from more primitive systems, and these give rise to all manner of complex emotions, ranging from self-satisfaction to unsatisfied longing. The evolutionarily primitive aspect of emotion helps to explain its power to disrupt thinking. When we are emotionally upset and complain that we can no longer think straight, we are, in fact, quite correct. The frontal lobes play an important part in working memory, and they cannot function well when the limbic system, involved in emotion, is dominant and demands full attention. This observation focused the attention of psychologists on finding out how control over emotions is acquired, and it has many practical applications, such as helping to change attitudes towards disruptive children who are slow to learn. Those who are distressed and disturbed will find it difficult to learn because of their high degree of emotional arousal, and their potential for school learning can be enhanced by alleviating their distress as much as, or more than, by increased teaching. Ornstein's The Evolution of Consciousness from 1991 says, "The pivot of the internal self is emotion. This dominant self-ish brain lies in frontal lobe and limbic system linkages that appraise threats in the environment and organize quick actions. Human beings can override this usual mode of operation. Actions can be reconsidered. We can learn and grow from experiences. Conscious control can modify ineffective tendencies. But most often and most reliably, especially in eras long gone, feeling our way through worked best." One of the most interesting unsolved problems in this field of psychology concerns the nature of the relationship between thoughts and feelings. Early theories of emotion focused primarily on the relationships between our experience of emotion and bodily changes, and on attempts to answer the chicken-and-egg type problem of which came first, the leap in the heart or the experience of the fear. These theories fail to explain how a particular perception is interpreted by the cognitive system, how we know that the situation we are in is dangerous, exciting, or safe. Cognitive labeling theory, or two-factor theory, developed in the early 1960s, stimulated a new approach to the study of emotion. According to this theory, emotional experience is determined by a combination of physiological arousal and the labeling, or interpretation, of the sensations experienced during that arousal. In order to test this theory, ingenious experiments were devised that involved varying some components of emotion while holding others constant. In one such experiment from 1962, the aim was to find out what will happen when people have similar physiological symptoms of arousal but experience emotionally different situations. The method used: some research subjects, supposedly participating in a test of the effects of a new vitamin on visual skills, were injected with adrenaline, which is physiologically arousing, and others were injected with a saline solution. Only some of those injected with adrenaline were correctly informed of its effects. While waiting for the drug to take effect, the subjects were put in a situation designed to produce either euphoria or anger, using a stooge. The results? After the waiting period, the emotion the subjects reported reflected the mood expressed by the stooge and was clearly influenced by social and cognitive factors. Those who had received the adrenaline injection but had not been correctly informed of its effects were most emotional. They were most likely to report feeling relatively happy or irritable later, according to how the stooge had behaved. Those subjects who had been correctly informed responded less strongly to the behavior of the stooge and appeared to attribute their experience at least partly to the injection. The conclusion: our awareness of the situation we are in influences the emotion that we actually feel. The findings from these experiments have been taken to demonstrate the role of cognition in the experience of emotion. What we experience is greatly influenced by cognitive factors, by what we know about a situation, by how we interpret what happens to us internally and externally, and, of course, by what we have learned and remembered about such situations in the past. Despite flaws in the experiments done at this time, cognitive labeling theory had a major impact, and subsequent research into cognitive aspects of emotion has contributed much to the understanding of emotional distress and to the development of psychological treatments. Cognitive therapies, particularly for depression and anxiety, are based on the idea that thoughts and feelings are so intimately related that changing one will change the other. As it is difficult to change feelings directly, cognitive therapies attempt to change them indirectly by working in therapy to change thinking, finding new ways of seeing things, or developing new perspectives. For example, the loss of a relationship may be interpreted as meaning that I will never find another partner, a thought which makes me sad and which makes it hard for me to get out and about to meet more people, but could also be interpreted as meaning that, although I am understandably upset, I still have the characteristics that my lost partner found attractive and can still make new friends. In other words, understanding more about the cognitive aspects of emotion has helped us to understand more of the intricacies of the relationships between thoughts, feelings, and behavior in general. In turn, this has guided the development of cognitive therapies, which are demonstrably effective in helping people who are experiencing a wide range of emotional difficulties. For many years, experimental psychologists paid little systematic attention to feelings, making the assumption that useful explanations of human behavior were more likely to be found elsewhere. Indeed, we do tend to assume that feelings get in the way, or that they interfere with otherwise rational behavior. And some psychologists seem to have assumed that feelings were more properly the province of clinicians, whose understanding of feelings is informed by personal qualities such as sensitivity and the ability to empathize, as well as by their knowledge of the more scientific aspects of psychology. This view, however, gives insufficient weight to the evolutionary functions of motivation and emotion. Fear organizes us for flight, anger for attack. Of course, feelings such as anger can get us into trouble as well as out of trouble, but without them we might put ourselves at risk, and we also depend on them for defining goals and organizing ourselves to work towards them. It has even been argued that there is such a thing as emotional intelligence, a quality that varies between people, that can be more or less successfully employed to help us achieve our aims, and which psychologists should study carefully so as to discover how to assist in its acquisition, development, or increasing sophistication. The study of motivation and emotion has contributed to clinical fields as widely different as those of psychoanalysis, humanistic and cognitive therapies, and the development of programs for those who need help with primary needs, such as eating, drinking, and sex, and with secondary needs such as smoking and gambling. It has been able to do so because in order to study feelings and to answer questions about why we do what we do, it has proved necessary to think in terms of many interacting systems: physical, cognitive, affective, behavioral, and sociocultural. The complexity of doing this means that there is still much to learn. Our increased understanding of the interactions between emotional arousal and the capacity to attend, learn, and remember has had some practical uses. For example, we have stopped using lie detectors, which only measure one component of emotion and cannot, therefore, be reliable. The complexity of the field may explain why there is still debate about such important issues as the effects of watching scenes of violence on television, and the question of whether it is better to bottle up anger or to express it.